Hi, this is Joe Muto, author of An Atheist in the Foxhole, in bookstores now. Also, you may know me better as Fox News. You can watch me on Mr. Media, find out what Bill O'Reilly is really like in bed. That was weird.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to former Fox News and Bill O'Reilly TV producer Joe Muto. He's the author of a terrifically entertaining new book, An Atheist in the Foxhole, a liberal's eight-year odyssey inside the heart of the right-wing media. Stick around. What doesn't kill Fox News only makes it stronger. How? I'll never know. Who are you people, anyway? So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of ditto heads, dunderheads, and confederacies of dunces in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. The funniest thing about Joe Muto's new book is that it took him less than 48 hours to undo an eight-year career as a TV producer at Fox News and 323 pages to prove he was in the wrong business all along. Looking for a great summertime read at the beach? Well, whether you're a lefty or a righty, whether you think Bill O'Reilly walks on water or wishes he was swimming with the fishes, you're going to be entertained, informed, and entirely astounded by Muto's first book, An Atheist in the Foxhole, a liberal's eight-year odyssey inside the heart of the right-wing media. You'll laugh, you'll cry, and then you'll turn the page and do it again. Muto, who spent 8 years mostly sublimating his liberal beliefs as he rose from production assistant in the dumpy Fox newsroom to producer for Bill O'Reilly on the O'Reilly Factor, tells a great story. Actually, he would make a smart advisor on Aaron Sorkin's HBO series, The Newsroom. In fact, he probably would have done well to tell his true story behind the scenes at Fox News as a Romana Clef. You know, disguising the facts in the same fair and balanced ways that Fox News itself does. The essence of Muto's story is that after 8 years of holding his tongue, and his nose, as a Fox News employee, something happened that he simply could not abide. He contacted the Gawker website and became known as the Fox Mole, a career that lasted significantly less time than Anderson Cooper's time hosting The Mole for ABC. Cooper's mole work led to CNN. Muto's brought him to Mr. Media. You do the math. Now, you don't have to love or hate Fox News to enjoy Foxhole. It's just a good story, well told, with insight into the most confounding major network in American television history. And with that, Joe Muto, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thanks so much for having me. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. Enjoyed reading the book. And I mean, I got a really simple question. Maybe we could just end the interview after this question. But what took you so long to create an exit strategy?
I mean, yeah, reading the book, you know, I probably should have left years and years ago. I probably should have ran screaming out of the building shortly after the 2008 election. I don't know what kept me there so long. If it was comfort, if it was, you know, you hit a certain inertia with work. Part of it was I was pretty good at it, you know, like I was, to toot my own horn, which I spent 330 pages doing, as you well know, I was good at what I did. I was a good producer. I, you know, even though I didn't agree with the politics of the place, I generally found the work interesting and engaging. So it wasn't, you know, I don't want to give the impression that I was, angry for 8 years every single day, 24/7. There were some enjoyable moments at the office.
Well, that's one of the things that I think comes across so well in the book is that, you know, once you accepted that this is where you were going to work, you went in, you did a job, you did the job well, you moved up, you were recognized, you were seen and moved up. But I got to tell you, I was thinking about this. Personally, me, 30 years in news and reporting and journalism, I wouldn't have lasted a week. And what it reminded me of, and I apologize, I wrote this down because I wanted to tell the story right. It reminded me of, and this was your first job out of college, but it reminded me of my first off-campus job during college. I got a job at Allen's Cubana in Gainesville, Florida, as a delivery boy. And the thing was, the first time I returned from delivering hot food to someone's house, and this is Gainesville, in the middle of July, it's hot, I'm dirty, I'm sweaty, and you know, that was just one trip. I came back, and they said, okay, now in between deliveries, you're going to do food prep. And I said, what? No, I'm hired to do delivery. And I said, you know, can I at least wash my hands? They said, no, we don't have time for that. And I walked out. I mean, that would be that's how long I lasted in something like that. I mean, that you lasted eight years.
8 years.
Astonishing to me. And
maybe I'm a masochist or something. I don't know.
You were never inculcated. I mean, you never bought the bullshit, right?
No. I never. You know, they never brought me over. You know, there were maybe one or two issues that I moved a little bit to the right on, but for the most part, I was just as left as I was when I started at the Blizz.
Well, and you know, I mean, personally, the thing that always confuses me. I'm willing to sit down, and I mean, my politics are fairly middle of the road. I'm willing to sit down and talk to my friends who are to the right. I have lunch with a buddy who I disagree with on everything politically. I mean, absolutely everything. He sees day, I see night, you know. But I watch when I watch the network, if they have a guest on, maybe that I'm interested in, I look for them to convince me that I'm wrong or that I should be open to their point of view. And I just never see it. I never see the intelligence behind the decisions, the choices. And so, you know, that you lasted there so long without being affected by it, I'm amazed.
Part of it might be that they're maybe not actively trying to convert people. You know, they are, it's the proverbial preaching to the choir. You know, they're assuming that their viewers already generally buy into what they're doing and, you know, don't need to be convinced any further than they are. You know, they're already on board.
Has there, I don't know if you know this, but has their overall audience, has it grown, or is it just that CNN and MSNBC's has shrunk?
That's a good question. I think their numbers have grown. Maybe past few years they've been flat, but they grew pretty wildly from when I started in 2004 until, you know, and kept growing throughout. And then spiked after the 2008 election. Like, that's really when you saw the numbers just explode. You know, nobody had seen numbers like that before. You know, and that was, you know, I based, or my guess was that was antipathy to President Obama, and that Fox sort of made itself the home for those who had a problem with the president.
Not that anyone could have a problem with the president of the United States. That would be disloyal.
Of course.
Not. Oh, I'm sorry. That was the party line during the Bush administration. Sorry, I don't mean to get confused.
Right. It's interesting how they shifted overnight from, you know, oh, if you protest against something President Bush does, you're treasonous, to, you know, 3 months after Obama took office, suddenly they're promoting tax day tea parties. It's like the real patriotic thing. Americans who just care about their country so much they had to speak out and don, you know, Revolutionary War costumes. That was very jarring to me, and that was, you know, the beginning of my disenchantment. Well, not that, that's probably not even true. I was disenchanted from the very beginning, but that was when it started to go sour for me, I think, more than anything.
And Joe, you said it's not like they're trying to convert the converted in terms of their viewers, but it is interesting that you write at the beginning of the book, when you go for your job interview, it was made clear to you that there was going to be an expectation for you to move up. You were hired as a production assistant, and that to get to the next level, there was someone that you would have to get by, basically the gatekeeper, and they want to make sure that you hold the beliefs and that you agree with what they hold so dear. You got through it anyway, even though,
you know, I lied my teeth, to get this thing, and everybody did, because even I say this in the book, even the truest of the true believers, the producers who buy into all the ideology, don't believe that we're there to be fair and balanced. That's not our job. Our job is to serve up red meat to our viewers. Our job is to, you know, rile them up and make them angry and make them outraged, and then they'll watch more TV. So, you know, we all knew that. And so I didn't feel, you know, I felt like I just had to say what I had to say to move on to the next level of my career. And that was early on. That was, you know, 5 or 6 months into my tenure there. And, you know, I was making $12 an hour. And by making it through this thing, we called it the Kool-Aid Conference, you know, drink the Kool-Aid. By making it through this thing, I think I got a raise to $12.74 an hour. So it was really, you know, lucrative on on my part.
And benefits.
Yeah, health, you know.
But there was actually, even before that, just to get the job, when you arrived in New York to get the job, you made a remark to the person interviewing you, something about, you know, do people really believe, what was it? I'm trying to remember what you said. Do people really believe this stuff, or, you know... And the person interviewing you was like a little alarmed, and you thought, oh, well, there goes the job.
Oh, yeah. Well, I questioned the journalistic relevance of – they were covering at the time this missing lady, Lacey Peterson, who, you know, had been – ended up getting – her husband was convicted of her murder eventually. And, you know, they were covering this a lot. They were covering it, you know, 40 minutes out of every hour. Mm-hmm. And I questioned that. I said, you know, are there – you know, do people who work here, are they angry that they have to cover, you know, tabloid stories like that? And the woman interviewing me was, you know, got really chilly all of a sudden. It had been a warm interview up to that point, and she suddenly goes, "No, well, you know, we would never question that because that's what our viewers want to see, and we're here for our viewers." And I, you know, my first tip off right there. I did think that I had blown the job interview at that point, but they called me 2 weeks later and offered me a gig, so who knows.
Well, and that was actually, I think, one of the B storylines in the first season of The Newsroom was this whole pushback from the owner of the news network in that show. Jane Fonda and her son are pushing for more, I don't know, more tabloidy stuff, more right-wing kind of stuff, and you know, there's this whole Newsroom contingent. It's like, do they really believe this stuff? Does anyone really believe it? And there you go.
Funny you bring up The Newsroom. I enjoy that show. I do get maybe some PTSD, PTSD flashbacks watching it. But, you know, they got a lot of details right, except for the degree that people in cable news are obsessed with ratings, because people in cable news are completely obsessed with ratings, and they would never look askance at their boss telling them to get the ratings up. They would never, ever, you know, think that was an unusual request.
Do you think no one at CNN has been asking for it for the last 2 or 3 years because they haven't done anything to?
I mean, that guy, the CNN president, the old guy, John Klein, lasted so much longer than anyone thought he was. You know, he was just failing and failing and failing, and finally they brought in Jeff Zucker, who you know, is at least shaking things up. I don't know if it's working quite yet.
Well, this being the entertainment industry, Klein will probably be running a major studio any day because they tend to fall upward.
Yeah.
What would be some examples of things that might possibly only happen at Fox News, I should say? I don't want to confuse the two. Fox is where they have The Simpsons. Fox News is where they have Hannity. So maybe it is pretty similar. Anyway, can you think of some examples of things that probably could only happen at Fox News?
I mean, no. Going out of getting off the elevator in the lobby and seeing Geraldo talking to you know, Gene Simmons from Kiss or something like that. That actually happened to me once. I was like, huh, that's interesting. that could only happen at Fox. I never worked inside another news organization, so I can't speak, you know, with a great degree of accuracy as to what it's like inside other places. But one thing about Fox that I've spoken about, and that people who work at other news organizations have been surprised about, is the level of sort of fear and paranoia amongst the staffers. People were honestly convinced that the newsroom was bugged, that there were audio listening devices installed by President Roger Ailes in the ceilings of the newsroom, and that he was listening for disloyal talk and, you know, liberal viewpoints. So people, you know, I didn't 100% believe it, but I didn't entirely disbelieve it either. Like, it seemed within the realm of possibility that this actually took place. So I think that level of paranoia is probably pretty unique to Fox News.
Well, when you find out, as we have in the last few months, the level of listening that the NSA is capable of, and then reading your book, the suspicion that people working there had that Ailes could be listening, allegedly could be listening. You're welcome, Roger. You know, it doesn't seem beyond the pale that that could be possible. Although, I would have to qualify it by saying, I don't think that Roger Ailes is listening. I think Roger probably has people who are listening.
Yes,
because Roger has to watch the channel at the same time.
Right. But, he has a security team. But, you know, we found out, you know, right around the time I was being fired, we found out that, you know, the fuller extent of News Corp's, you know, hacking and bugging activities in England. So it's not a huge reach to assume that they're doing something similar in the United States.
Exactly. And by the way, folks, that spoiler. So much for the surprise ending of the book. I'm kind of curious, in 8 years there, I mean, I kidded at the beginning of the show about your not having an exit strategy until that point. Did you, I know the answer because I read the book, but did you not apply elsewhere over the course of time and look for jobs elsewhere?
Should have thought of that. Now that you mention it, you know, there were other applications. Over the years, nothing sort of panned out. And by the time that I was ready to leave for good, and I knew I just had to get out, or I would, you know, jump out a window. I was pretty burned out on cable news as a whole. You know, I was like, I'm pretty done with this industry. So it didn't seem like applying for other cable news jobs was something I wanted to do. So what I wanted to do was write, which is how I ended up talking to Gawker. You know, I wanted to be a writer for them. That's how I ended up as the mole.
Well, I'd like to talk about that, but I also feel like if we do too much, it kind of gives away an interesting twist at the end there. But in terms of the writing, I meant what I said. I mean, I told you this before we started the interview. I think this book reads incredibly well. I can't believe that you weren't doing writing or publishing during those 8 years. It seems like in 10 years you're going to look back and go, "Damn, I wasted those 8 years, best years of my life at Fox when I could have been writing." And look at all the output I would have had. It's a really good book.
Well, you know, I guess I could always say I was researching. You know, I was doing research for my first book. So I'm glad. Thank you. That's a great compliment. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And I always wanted to. I set out to write something entertaining and funny and that people would enjoy reading, not just a screed against Fox. You know.
Now, did you ever read a book called Primary Colors back?
I love that book.
By Anonymous, of course, turned out to be Joe Klein from Newsweek. It's almost a shame that you didn't think to do that here. That would have been a much better Fox Mole job to have written that and done it as Romana Clef, which is, you know, true facts but disguising the names and certain things. And then because what I felt really bad about when I got to the end of the book, I wanted the same detail from inside Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck's operation. I wanted you to go back in and then write a book about each of their operations, and unfortunately that's not going to happen now.
I agree with you. That would have been a great way to go with this. I'm not 100% happy with the way it played out. You know, I maybe wish I had exited a little bit more quietly. I don't regret leaving Fox. I was done with Fox. I couldn't take it anymore. But I do wish I had maybe, you know, had a more dignified exit to my 8-year career.
Well, let's talk about some of the stars of the story and of Fox News in general, because a couple of these people aren't necessarily stars of the story. They're in the story, but they're definitely Fox people, and you have some definite insight into them. And I have to start with Sarah Palin, who, since you've left Fox, has resurfaced there. And I wondered if her being let go and then coming back when you were gone, if there's some connection between the two of you. Was there like a secret romance that, you know, had?
Well, yeah, you know, that's why she left in the first place. She couldn't take it without me. Without me in the building. Palin. I don't talk about her too much in the book, but there's a pretty, I think, memorable section in the book where she first shows up. And I was I was not one bit surprised when they fired her, because as I say in the book, she was just not working out. She was a horrible, they hired her for on-air analysis and she was terrible at it. Mm. And she didn't make an attempt to even be good at it. She was just, you know, she was lazy, like she was as a governor. It sounds like, you know, she didn't want to put in the hours, or even the minutes. It would take her minutes to prepare for each segment. She didn't even want to do that.
You mean like what newspapers do you read, Governor? Yes. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, none of them. She said all of them. She meant none of them.
Yeah.
No, but you know, when they fired her, and I said, oh, yeah, of course they fired her. She was giving them nothing. Her, you know, she's not even that popular amongst people who are inclined to like her in the first place. But then a few months later, they hired her back, and that was just a month or two ago. I think they hired her back. And that was shocking to me. I was shocked. I cannot understand why they would bring her back. She brings nothing to the network. She's not, you know, she's not a serious person, and she's not even entertaining anymore because she just repeats the same talking points. She's not even giving good red meat, you know. They brought her in for red meat. She's not even bringing it. My guess is maybe she just wanted too much. When it came time to renew the contract, she wanted a bit too much money, and they said, you know, you're not worth it, and she stormed away in a huff and then, you know, came back hat in hand a few months later. That's my guess.
For a little less money. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense. And I got to ask you this, because one of the things that a lot of people say is, okay, maybe she's not that bright, but she's really good looking. I haven't really bought into that. I mean, I mean no disrespect, and I don't want to lower this, but at Fox, looks are very important. I mean, you write about that. The blonde bimbo type anchor is very important at Fox. You've been up close and personal with Governor Palin. Is she that good looking?
She's pretty good looking in person. I'm not. I'll give her at least that. She is a. You know, if you're familiar with the term MILF,
yeah,
she is a very, very attractive woman, and she is charismatic.
Okay.
You know, when she entered Fox, you know, her first appearance there as a contributor, she entered like a conquering hero, and people were lining the halls and like applauding her, and she was doing the, you know, the prom queen wave, like she was on a homecoming parade float or something like that. It was a real sight to see. So you know, I will not take that away from her. She has charisma. She has looks. She just doesn't have anything interesting to say or add to the conversation.
Okay, well that's fair. And I said just based on seeing her on TV, I just never really got that part of it. All right, let's talk about another prom queen from Fox, Sean Hannity. What is the deal with this guy? I don't get it. I've tried watching him. I tried watching him when he was opposite Alan Colmes. I've tried watching him alone. It just seems like he's as far off the deep end as Glenn Beck, but he's not seen that way. What's the deal?
Yeah. He is the hackiest of all the hacks to me, Sean Hannity. And to just live his life in this constant state of anger and vitriol, you know, towards Democrats and towards President Obama. I mean, you know, O'Reilly is no stranger to anger, but even he is not, I think, as constantly angry and derisive as Sean Hannity. You know, and in Hannity's case, it's kind of an act. He's not, you know, he's a broadcasting professional. When the mic's off, he's slapping backs and, you know, shaking hands with, you know, Keith Olbermann in the green room. They were pals, I think, at one point, which is so bizarre. You know, so Hannity is he's popular, but he's only second, or even at this point third in the Fox lineup. This new show, The Five, which is, you know, the panel show at 5 p.m., is wildly, wildly popular. So that seems to be doing pretty well, and is sort of usurping Hannity at number two.
Well, and that brings us to, speaking of the lineup, Megyn Kelly, who has announced, it's been announced, she's going to get her own primetime show. Everyone's trying to figure out, well, where? Where are they going to fit her in? You know, yeah, like you said, I mean, The Five has been very popular. O'Reilly is still, you know, king of the evenings. What First of all, tell folks about Megyn Kelly. You were there. You expected that she was going to rise. This was not a big surprise to you. But tell folks who may not know her a little about Megyn Kelly.
Well, she's the classic. Physically, she's the perfect fox specimen. She's blonde. She's pretty. She's leggy. And also temperament wise, she's perfect. She's feisty, but she's still got a sense of humor about her. She's smart. She's a lawyer. She was a lawyer for a few years before before she got into broadcasting. Although I feel like she dumps herself down for TV sometimes. She acts less smart than she is, especially when she's on O'Reilly. She does a guest on O'Reilly's show. But she is now doing 2 hours in the afternoon, which is not a terrible slot. I think she does 1 to 3. She's 1 to 3 or noon to 2. I can't remember which. Which is not exactly a prime slot. But they just announced that she's going on maternity leave, and when she gets back from maternity leave, she gets a prime time slot. Now that was apparently news to Greta Van Susteren, who has the 10 o'clock slot and is the most likely on the chopping block. Greta claimed in a blog post that her contract stipulates she gets a primetime slot. So it's sort of it's an open question at this point what their strategy is. I mean, they have I'm guessing at least 6 months to figure it out while she's on leave. My guess is maybe they're going to try to buy Greta out of her contract or something. That's my best guess. Or maybe they'll offer her a weekend show or something like that, weekend prime time. There's some room there. They can move Geraldo around.
MSNBC did with the Ed show, just kind of shuffle him off. Even though he was popular and drew and he certainly walked the company line if there is one, but he got shuffled off to weekends. Do you think it's that certain that it's Greta? I mean, it couldn't possibly be Sean, and it couldn't be Bill, right?
Yeah, they'll take Bill's show from his cold dead hands. He intends to die in that anchor chair, I think, when he's 95 years old. And Hannity, just doing the math, O'Reilly's number one, Hannity's number two, Greta's number three, ratings wise. So you don't want to replace your two guys who are doing good or who are doing better. So you replace Greta. Now, Ailes is a creative guy. He could come up with some sort of solution where, they co-anchor or, they each get half an hour.
That'll go well, I'm sure.
I mean, either way, it's a demotion for someone. There's 3 hours of prime time and there's 3 hour long shows in prime time. Someone is getting demoted either by moving slots or sharing their show or, That's just the math.
I'm gonna make a terribly sexist remark, and I apologize in advance for it. But knowing the calculus that Roger Ailes tends to use in terms of these very beautiful women that he puts all throughout the lineup, I gotta figure that at 10 o'clock he's thinking, how can I keep more eyeballs? How can we maintain, the numbers from Hannity and O'Reilly? And that would be perhaps we need a more attractive looking woman in that seat. It's 10 o'clock. You're starting to drift off. But, if it's Megyn Kelly instead of Greta Van Susteren with her thousands of dollars worth of very unfortunate plastic surgery, who would you rather look at? Well, I got to go with him on this. I think it's got to be Megyn Kelly. Greta Van Susteren's, plus there was that rumor that was out about a week or two ago, I think, that Greta had gone back and had been talking to CNN about returning there. So that probably didn't win her any favorites.
I think that's what prompted this announcement. Otherwise, they would have waited, until they had a definite plan. It was kind of unusual for them to announce and say, well, when she comes back from maternity leave, she's going to get a show, but no details forthcoming. It's all about demographics, because Greta still handily beats the competition in her time slot as far as total viewers, but she, her competition, I think, is Maddow on MSNBC, is pretty close to her in the demographic, the under 55 demographic, which is, the only one advertisers care about. So Ailes has got to be thinking, I can get Greta out of there, get a younger, more attractive blonde in there. That's got to get some younger eyeballs, in that time slot. So But like, but you know, Greta's not going to go quietly. I'll tell you that right now. If they force her out, I mean, she is pretty outspoken. She's got her blog and everything. And she'll, you know.
Well, listen. I mean, it didn't hurt Glenn Beck to go out and, you know, set up a $90 million a year operation for himself. So it's not like she doesn't have options. So I'm not going to worry about her too much.
Yeah, she'll land on her feet.
Now, there's not much in the book about another Fox woman, Ann Coulter, but you really, I think you, I mean, you really nail her in your portrayal of her. At least I thought so. It would be what I expected. You want to tell folks about a little about your encounters with Ann?
Is it, well, yeah. I mean, I never, as a liberal, as a red-blooded far left moon, I never, as O'Reilly would say, I still do some O'Reillyisms every now and again. It's hard to shake it out of your system. I wanted to hate Ann Coulter as much as I've ever wanted to hate someone my entire life. You know, I'd never, she just would go on TV and say the most vile, hateful things. And, you know, those things always coincided mysteriously with her book launches. I don't know how she timed that. But she would say the most horrible things, and I guess it worked for her. She sold millions and millions of books. So I expected that she would, you know, when I met her in person, I produced a couple segments for her for O'Reilly's show. When I met her in person, that she'd be like that, and I was prepared to, you know, hate her guts while producing her. But as it turns out, no. So soft-spoken, sweet, nice, you know, in the green room. In the green room, she's great. She's joking around with the makeup ladies. She's, you know, she's gossiping. She's making jokes. She's, you know, she's pretty nice and entertaining. And then as soon as the camera starts rolling, she's, you know, she's horrible Anne again. And it's a weird two-faced thing. But it's, you know, that's pretty common in the broadcast industry, as it turns out. They're not, you know, they know they have a persona to live up to, and they do a good job of it.
Well, I was not surprised by your description of her. I could not imagine that she could be the Dragon Lady all the time. It just seemed like a largely an act, because it sold tickets, it sold books, and it worked for her. But I mean, I'm sure she believes most of those things herself, but to be as vile and heinous as she is when she speaks on TV, it's just astonishing. Okay, so we've meandered the path here. We got to come to your final boss at Fox News, which is Bill O'Reilly. And before we talk about him, I wonder if you could talk as him. I understand from reading the book that you can, you know, you, like everyone who worked for him, could do a pretty fair impression of Bill.
The thing I heard the most from him is my desk was right by his office, you know, maybe 20 feet away. And if he ever wanted someone, he wouldn't call them on the phone usually. He'd just yell out of his office until someone answered him. So he'd be, Mudo, get in here. Mudo, I need you. Mudo, you know, like... Or he would just yell for people, and you know, yell for other random people on the staff, hoping they'd be in the hall. And if they didn't answer him after a while, he'd just start yelling for or Stavikoff, Garcia, get in. You know, like he just start naming people on the staff, hoping that someone would come in and attend to his whims. Yeah, but everyone does his voice like this. So look, here's what we're gonna do. You know, like he's. He's really it's infectious. It's this deep voice, and you know, it barks orders at you all day long. So it gets into your head. It's a weird psychological thing.
Now, when you're in a production meeting with him, and you're pitching stories, no one cares what a good day is like. Tell us what a bad day is like. What does a bad day in a production meeting with Bill O'Reilly sound like?
Well, good days are so few and far between. I don't even know if I remember what they're like at this point. We are set up for failure in these pitch meetings. He is seated in a chair, mm-hmm. and we're lined up in a little semicircle around him. We, the producers, you know, there's about a dozen of us all in our sort of late 20s, early 30s. And we're standing, he's seated, we're standing in a semicircle around him. We've all got our little, you know, computer printouts in our trembling hands. And he sits there and he just points. He goes, Mudo, you're up. What do you got, you know? And points at you, and you have to step up and very clearly and concisely sort of recite, you know, what your story is. And you gotta package it for him a little, you know, and just say, oh, Bill, there's a, you know, there's a liberal mayor in Vermont, and he's making, you know, he wants to ban Christmas this year. You know, like, it's you got to package it like that. Now, that would have been a good pitch. He would love that pitch. He loves the Warren Christmas pitches. But those pitches are few and far between. Normally what happens is you pitch something and he tears it to bits. You know, you're like, nope, boring. Nope, too small. You know, we can't do that. That's too, you know. And that's if you're lucky. If you're lucky, he'll just dismiss it curtly and say, and, you know, move on to the next story or the next producer. If you're unlucky, you know, you'd be like, that is the dumbest pitch I've ever heard. I don't know how you could even think that would make it onto the show. You know, and then he launched into a lecture. The rest of you, listen to that pitch. That was terrible. I want nothing like that. You guys need to, step it up, improve your game, that kind of thing. So if you're lucky, he'll just dismiss it quickly. If you're unlucky, he'll either get angry or, you know, make fun of you and call you an idiot.
And it seemed like from what I read that the worst thing that could happen is not only does he shoot you down and you go down in flames, but the person who has to pitch after you has got it even worse because he's really pissed off now and he thinks you're an idiot. So he's going to think the next person is even bigger idiot, even if they have a good idea.
Yeah, one bad pitch can poison the entire staff, and they all hate you. Their good pitches don't make it through. But then, you know, if you have a pitch and you think it's a good pitch and he shoots it down on a Monday, mm-hmm. you try to pitch it again on the Thursday, you know, the Thursday, 3 days later, and he'll take it sometimes because, you know, he forgets it. He has a lot on his mind. He'll forget that you pitched it in the first place. Or, you know, it really does depend on his mood. You know, sometimes you can, you know, if he's in a good mood, he'll be more receptive to, you know, wackier pitches, I think.
The thing that comes across in the book, and then you actually come out and say it near the end, is that despite not agreeing with O'Reilly on his political takes or his stances on a lot of things, the reader comes away with a strong feeling that you respect him. And you talk about that at the end. You come out and say it. But I think it was actually clear, and this is one of the things I liked about the way the book was written. You can read the book, and this is why I think people who are Fox News hounds, if you will, people who support Fox News, who may think that it's disloyal to read a book like this, they should read it anyway because it's interesting to get your stories describing him. But at the end, you literally come out and say, you know, I think you said something to the effect of you don't hate O'Reilly. You actually kind of admire him because he works really hard. He's very well organized. He knows what he wants to do. It's not like Palin coming in day after day, being unprepared, not having anything to say. You know, if O'Reilly gets the talking points, that the supposed talking points that the left has and the right has and that circulate, O'Reilly has his own intelligent take on it. You don't have to agree with it. But he has his point of view, and he works at it. And, you know, it comes across, you say. I mean, you do have a grudging respect for that.
He does, yeah. You know, I compare it to, like, your, you know, conservative uncle, you know, having to put up with him at Thanksgiving or something like that. That's, you know, that's the kind of, you know, you can't completely hate the guy even if you disagree with him. And he is, and you're right, there is a work ethic there. I mean, And there's a vision that he has for the show, and it's entirely his vision. You know, there's not a lot of other anchors have, you know, an army of producers who sort of step in and fill in all the intellectual gaps. O'Reilly's not like that with the show. It is all him. It's his, you know, it's his viewpoint. He writes the whole script himself. He'll dictate it on the car ride in, which is a fascinating process to observe. You know, there is. I do have a respect for him to that extent. He's been number one in his time slot in the ratings for, God, going on 14 years now, I think. And you know that sort of thing doesn't happen by accident. You know, there is, you know, that is due to his talent, I guess you would call it.
Well, so we've come full circle here. I've done my best not to give away too much of the important stuff. There is kind of that dual thread running through the book that makes it really interesting to read. I'll let people discover that. I hope they will. The big question, of course, is besides promoting the book now, what are you doing with yourself? What's ahead for you?
Well, I am working on my second book. It will not be about Fox News.
Damn.
I know. I think that well is dry now. You know, like I think there's nothing. I've scraped the bottom of the well. There's nothing left. I think it'll be fiction. You know, I'm talking with the agent, seeing what's hot out there. Maybe a Harry Potter ripoff. We'll see what's selling.
All right.
Hunger Games or something like that. I do have another job as well. Not in the news, thankfully, because I was burnt out on the news. So I am, you know, I'm working for a tech startup here in New York. So I'm not completely destitute as
as
many people predicted I would be. So I'm pretty happy about that. But you know, it was a wild ride at Fox. I don't really regret any of it though. I don't think I regret a single minute of it.
Very good. All right. Well, folks, listen. You can find An Atheist in the Foxhole, a liberal's 8-year odyssey inside the heart of the right wing media, written by my guest today, Joe Muto. It's in great stores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price here at MrMedia.com. If you're watching the video on the site, just below the video, look right over there, most likely. Yeah.
So,
yeah, I don't think you want to point
right
here. Yeah, that's a little too...
I got your book right here.
Exactly. There should be a cover of the book there somewhere, maybe covering something else up, but there should be a copy of the book there. You can click on it right now. It'll take you to Amazon. You'll get it at the best possible price. Joe, you've got a website, I think, joemuto.com, joemuto.com. And I think you're on Twitter and Tumblr.
I am. Joe Muto on Tumblr, and I think, yeah, and you can go to my blog to find, or my website, joemuto.com, to find my Tumblr site, which I probably need to start updating a little bit more now that I'm a semi-public, you know, slightly internet infamous person.
I would do that. I think the next thing you should put there is probably your Mr. Media interview. That's what I would do.
Actually not a bad idea.
Interesting idea. Yes. Well, I really did enjoy reading the book, and I really do recommend it to people on whatever side they're on, because it's just really interesting to get inside that that operation and learn something about it. And I hope you'll have equal or greater success with your second book, and you'll come back and talk to us about it then.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for joining us on Mr. Media today. You can see and hear almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Stitcher favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest 2-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Mark Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, The TechCrunch Headlines, and The Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at stitcher.com/Mr. Media. That's stitcher.com/MR Media. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, corporate event, or just a big old party, please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJs, the party authority for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJS or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJS.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening.